Hi, gang. This is Officer Dawn. We thought you'd like to hear a song about one of your favorite television games. Do you remember the game Ooey Gooey? Now the sacks go round and round, and the gang makes the funniest sound. You put your hand in, you take your hand out. Ooey Gooey.
Hello, and welcome to Session 2 of First Person, an oral history chronicle of American broadcast television by some of the people that have led the way in an industry that's been changing since it was born. By speaking directly to those that were there and had a front row seat, our goal is to preserve the events, innovations, and personalities that helped shape the technology, companies, productions, shows, systems, and more that are all necessary parts of broadcast television. Today's guest is Don Kennedy, who has a one-of-a-kind career. Although the Bozo the Clown Show was the country's number one syndicated kids show, Don, or better yet, Officer Don, was actually America's top independent host. His show, The Clubhouse Gang, which later became the Popeye Club, ran every weekday afternoon here in Atlanta from 1956 until 1970. But he was a lot more than just Officer Don. He also owned a background music business, a radio station, and a television station, and is still active with his syndicated Big Band Jump show. On a personal note, I grew up in Atlanta and was on both shows, once around 1957, the other time around 1960. And I can tell you that in Georgia, the name Don Kennedy is more well-known and warmly regarded than just about any other Georgian ever has been, except for possibly Scarlett O'Hara. So, with that said, let's get started. And the first question is Don Kennedy your real name?
Absolutely. It's Donald Calvin, C-A-L-V-I-N, Kennedy.
Is it?
Yeah.
What about Derek Schlottenhaupt?
Schlottenhaupt, yeah. I did a voiceover for a middle-of-the-night film that I really didn't want my name connected with. It was a little too blue. And so I told them to call me Derek Schlagenhaupt. And now it says, also known as... So that didn't work.
Donna, you and I have a lot in common. You got started really early in radio, and I think you were, 13 when you tried out?
Yeah, my first audition was 13. I'm sure they laughed a lot. It was in Sharon, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Youngstown, Ohio, and I was a fan of that station, and I went out there to hang around. It was a classic station that was built in 1937 with all Western Electric equipment, and just classic with soundproof doors, you know, big thick doors, and on-the-air signs, and a separate control room to it was just a wonderful station. And so I took an audition there on an old RCA, Western Electric birdcage. And I'm sure they laughed at me a lot, but they said that they would keep my audition on file. Of course, didn't record it, because in those days there was no tape.
Right.
This was 1943.
Right.
So they didn't want to bother to use an acetate disc, because we're talking about a couple of bucks here. And so when I was 17... I got a call from them. In the meantime, I'd been hanging around and sort of making an acquaintance with the staff, which changed rapidly. And when I was 17, I got a call from them, and they said, we're starting this new thing called FM, and we're going to need some extra announcers part-time. Would you like to do it? Well, I was a senior in high school, and so I said, yeah, I can work on the weekends. And so I did. I worked 1947 and 48 there. Every weekend, I would drive out Friday afternoon. My mother would put some blankets and a pillow in a bag, and I slept in the basement. There was a couch in the basement and a fireplace. It was a rec room.
Right.
And so I would sleep in the basement, and the turntable operators, they had female turntable operators, would come down and wake me up when it was time for me to go on shift on Saturday morning, which was about 10 o'clock. And I would clean up in the restroom and zip into the control room and the announce booth and go to work.
Well, you actually, though, didn't let not working for a licensed broadcast station hold you back, didn't you? Weren't you one of the first radio pirates? Didn't you build a station?
Yeah, it really was a pirate station in a very small sense. It was at 550 kilohertz, as a matter of fact. And it was an old phonograph oscillator, and I juiced up the plate current. And it must have gotten out maybe a half block. And I put an antenna in the pear tree, and it worked out fine. I broadcast every night for a year from 6 to 7 o'clock at night. Started out with 5 minutes of news that I read from the front page of the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, and then I had a program called Don's Dance Date. How clever is that? and one called The Wax Works, and then I had a poetry program that I did every night, and I played organ music and read poetry from an Edgar Guest poem book. It was pretty bad.
Well, you went into the service pretty soon after that, didn't you?
No, I after 1 year, my folks insisted I go to college, and my school principal, who was the father of one of my classmates, also insisted I go to college. I was president of the junior and senior class in high school and also on the honor roll, the honor society. And he just insisted that I go to college. And so he enrolled me in the college 5 miles from my home in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, Geneva College. Without asking, it was a small town and everybody took care of everybody else. So I was forced to go to college. I didn't want to. I wanted to go to work. I wanted to stay at WPIC in Sharon for the rest of my life.
Right.
At that time. And so I got a job at a news station that was opening up in Beaver Falls. Some guys from Pittsburgh had come down to open a local station. A lot of them were opening up then, and it was a 1230 frequency. And they called it WBVP, Beaver Valley, Pennsylvania, it stood for.
When would this be, roughly, around 19...
It was exactly May 25th, 1948.
Wow.
But that's when the station signed on the air, and I started to college in September of that year.
When did you come to Atlanta?
It was 1953. I went into the Army in 55. I went into the Army in 53 after working 5 years at WBVP, which was probably my best experience, and a good station, 21 people on the staff. It was a really heads-up station.
Right.
Run by people who knew radio. Anyway, I went into the Army in 53, worked at a studio there at Psychological Warfare at Fort Bragg, because the war was running down in Korea. And so I got out in 55. I came here February 14th, Valentine's Day in 1955.
Did you go to work for WSB or?
No. No, I came here without a job. I had $180 mustering out pay. And I met a friend in the Army who was from Atlanta, and he used to use our studio. He was an announcer in Atlanta, and so he suggested I move to Atlanta. And I got a job first at WBGE. I can't remember the frequency. It was 1320 or something. But it had the studios in the basement of the Georgian Terrace.
Yeah.
And at that time, they couldn't afford the studio line, the transmitter line. So I worked at the transmitter building, which was a couple of blocks up the street on Pine Street, which is now an entrance to the expressway. In a building, an old building, in the basement of the building was where the transmitter was, and they also had one of those silly FMs, which they gave up, stupidly. At any rate, the FM came on at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I worked Saturday and Sunday for a buck an hour. It was just a part-time job. And then I got a call. I had audition tapes all over the city.
Right.
And I got a call from Elmo Ellis. I didn't know who he was at WSB Radio. And he wanted me to come to work there. And I turned him down. And the reason I did was because I had promised Henry Lanham, who was the manager of the station and owner, I promised him I was going to do an afternoon ball score show and a record show. He liked my work. And And so he was going to pay me $70 a week to do this show, or 65, I can't remember. And I had had an agreement with him, and I thought I couldn't violate that agreement, so I turned Elmo down. I wanted to go to work for SBA, but I turned him down. And the very next day, I got a call from Mark Tolson, the production manager at WSB-TV. And he said, I understand you're turning down work all the time, all over the place. And I told him, he said, I want you to come to work as a booth announcer. And I couldn't turn that down because TV was, you know, the thing. And I called my dad in Beaver, Pennsylvania, and I was in tears. I was on the air announcing, in, you know, and talking to my dad during the record.
Right.
And this is a time when long-distance calls were not usual.
Right.
So I called my dad, and I said, Dad, I don't know what to do. I said, I promised Mr. Lanham that I'm also. Yeah, I went through the story. And he said, Don, if Henry Lanham had a chance to sell that station, and one of the conditions was that you be fired, he wouldn't hesitate. So I took the job, and 6 months later, Henry Lanham sold the station, and the entire staff was fired. So I went to work as a booth announcer at WSB, very similar to radio, obviously, and learned some TV along the way. Don Heald and Ruth Kent allowed me to do some stuff on television. I'd done some stage work and live stuff, you know, in high school and college. And
was Ruth doing Today in Georgia then?
Yes, indeed. She was the star of Today in Georgia.
Do you know when that started, Today in Georgia?
I don't know. I don't know. This was obviously 1955. I went to work at SB in April Fool's Day, 1955. And they were still in a little building back of White Columns. In the basement of that building was where the studios were. And they let me do some interviews. I remember I interviewed Joan Woodward. Yeah, she had just done Three Faces of Eve. And that was my really first interview on Today in Georgia. But before that, I did spots on the Armchair Playhouse, which was an old movie that they ran from 1 to 3.
I remember it well.
Yeah, or 12:30 to 3, 12:15, I guess. And I also did interviews on Don Heald's Noon News, which was an Atlanta Gaslight thing.
Yes, remember it well.
And I was the last 5 minutes, and I had to scrape up a civic interview. And we're talking live, of course, so the person had to come in, and I interview them on the desk next to Don after he did 10 minutes of news. And that's the way I kind of got broken in, and I got used to it fairly quickly, and then we did a lot of stuff on the air.
Right around the time you were offered or forced to, into Officer Don, were you doing the 11 o'clock news?
Yeah, I did the 11 o'clock news, 57 and 58. I did the news when Sputnik went up, and I did the news when Orville Faubus stood in the door of the Central High School in Little Rock. Those were all news stories that I remember very well. I liked doing 11 o'clock news.
How did you come to be Officer Don?
A guy named Gary Stradling was the one who broke me in. He was the booth announcer when I got to work. But he never appeared on camera because he wasn't very good-looking.
Right.
However, Gene Hendricks, who was the program director at the time, went to New York, and on PIX, Channel 11 in New York, was a guy named Joe Bolton who did Officer Joe. He was the friendly New York policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a clubhouse and all that stuff. And so Gene Hendricks assigned Gary Stradling to be Officer Joe. And I was still in the booth and just doing occasional on-camera things. And Gary wasn't very good on the air, and the ratings were lousy, and Mickey Mouse Club was just beating the hell out of us.
That was on Channel 11.
Yeah.
Right.
It was ABC at the time.
The Popeye Club was on from 4 to 5 or 5 to 6? 4 to 5.
Well, it was on variously from 4 to 5 and 4:30 to 5:30.
Only Atlanta. Somebody from Atlanta might ask this question, but did you replace Woody Willow?
No, everybody thinks that. Woody Willow actually was on in the afternoon, and Officer Joe replaced Woody Willow. But Woody Willow was for younger kids, and it went to the morning.
Oh, it was a morning show.
Well, it was then, when when Officer Joe started, it moved to morning. And it was on, I think, at 11 o'clock following today in Georgia. So the Gilpins just did the same show, but they did it in the morning instead of the afternoon.
Did any of those people carry over from that show to were they in the Popeye Club or Clubhouse Gang at all? Any of the...
Oh, no, there was no crossover.
Well, when you started the Clubhouse Gang, there was nobody, you didn't have any other sidekicks or characters in the Clubhouse Gang.
No, it was just me, and we made characters out of the prop man, Bobby Thomas, Uncle Bobby.
Right.
And we made characters out of the director, Uncle John, and the glass cage.
I remember all that, yes.
Part of it, because that's the observation booth where the parents sat. And I used to go up and visit the parents and the younger kids who weren't able to come on the show during the cartoons so they wouldn't feel left out. And it worked out very well. By the second month I was on the air, we beat Mickey Mouse.
Really?
Oh, yeah, just trashed him.
Well, did they have Arbitron back then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't Arbitron, but they did have ratings back then. I can't remember the name of the rating company, but it's gone now.
Well, you were probably one of the top five shows of its kind in the country, right?
We were the leading local big kid show in the country, local kid show, mostly because of the dominance of Channel 2. I can't take any credit for it, but you know, Channel 2 was so dominant.
Yes.
All over the state because of early cable, everything.
Right.
You know, and we used to get kids from Macon and Savannah even watched. It was amazing.
They could see it there?
Yeah, yeah. Later on, they had cable feeds, actually a microwave feed to Savannah. It was unbelievable. SB was everywhere.
I didn't know that. I grew up in North Georgia, and I would just obviously receive it on regular broadcast. And the show ran from 56 to 70, which is a huge run. But when did people outside of the Atlanta viewing area get their first look at it?
I don't know. I was so insulated, you know, just working for WSB and all that sort of thing. My concentration was really doing the show. I didn't know. I knew that it was successful, but I didn't pay much attention to who was watching. I did, of course, make appearances at theaters, which was strictly a money-making thing. I would take 1,000 printed pictures of me and a bunch of tickets and some 35-millimeter reels of Popeye cartoons to theaters on the weekend. And I appeared all over the 70-mile radius of SB.
How much time did you have to fill per show? Was it like 50-50?
Yeah, you know, I've never been asked that question. The cartoons were about 7 minutes, and there were five of them. So, it was about 50-50.
What kind of show prep did you do?
Yeah, the strange thing is we didn't do any. It was all just so freewheeling. And I was young and kind of reckless, and I would try anything. And so we just went wild, and a lot of double-meaning stuff happened, and it was great fun. It was great fun to do. I look forward to it every day.
Well, you didn't have any kids, and you were a little apprehensive about that, weren't you, because you didn't quite...
Yeah, I was apprehensive at the beginning, and I didn't think I would get along with kids because I didn't have any kids, and it was just my wife and I. But I found out that I found out that my outlook was more childlike than I knew. And I was kind of, you know, I'm still immature, and so it helped a great deal. And I treated the kids like they were adults. That was one thing that I insisted on, is that everybody treat them like adults. None of this boys and girls crap. They were sir and ma'am and that kind of thing.
I remember that. Wasn't Bobby Thomas the floor manager?
Yeah. Well, Ivy Peterson was at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Pete Peterson?
Yeah, Pete Peterson. And his name was really Ivy. I mean, that's a real given name.
Right.
Yeah, Pete was the floor manager, and he taught me a lot, too. In fact, he was floor manager when I did my first live appearance on camera, scared to death. It was over in the old building, and it was in the middle of a movie, and there was a spot for Ready Whip. This was within, a couple of months of the time I started. And he had some Jell-O out there and a Ready Whip can, and we rehearsed it. And he said, now don't squirt the Ready Whip, because it's the only Jell-O I've got on the rehearsal. Just make believe you're squirting it, and damned if I didn't squirt it. And so he had to wash it off in the sink, you know, at the last minute before the break came in the movie.
Right.
And I remember being so frightened, and my hands were perspiring so much there was a puddle on the desk there by the Ready Whip.
I've heard stories that there was an announcer, not you, but somebody on the staff, was so bad about showing up to do live spots. They'd show up 10 seconds before it was time to go, and the crews got so mad at him that one day that they, when the, you know, the paper teleprompters started to roll, there was nothing on it. And he was never late again. Do you know who that was?
Actually, it could have been one of those guys that did play-by-play baseball. What was the name of that early guy that did it for the Braves?
Milo?
Milo, yeah. He was universally disliked.
Did you ever work with Roger Marks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he directed the show part-time. There were several directors. Roger and John Cohn was the one who directed it most often, and a guy named Jerry Johnson. Those were the three that I worked with.
I never knew Roger did that. I always thought Roger was a news director.
Well, he did, you know, a director worked the entire shift and directed the news and whatever was on the shift.
Right, right.
So he probably directed the Popeye Club and then had a half hour off while they ran some sitcom, and then he would direct the news.
Now, I know that there's not a convention of sorts for you kids show hosts, but did you ever know other guys around the country that did what you were doing?
Actually, there was a convention one time. Burger King, which advertised on all of the Southeast on kids shows, had a convention for us at the Doral down in Miami. And we all went down, and we all appeared on Skipper Chuck's show on WTVM, I think it is.
TBJ.
TVJ, yeah. And Skipper Chuck, nice guy.
Yeah.
And we all had a little bit on his two-hour Saturday morning show. They taped it by that time. This was later when tape was invented. And, yeah, I met some of the guys. Some of them were crazy as bed bugs, and some of them were almost like school teachers, and there were every kind of person.
Speaking of tape and capabilities of recording. Now, bumping up against the news like you did, I think probably a lot of people in the engineering in the tape room were pretty busy. And how many of the Clubhouse Gang shows and Popeye Club shows got taped and are still with us? Do you know?
None? Yeah, the only tape left over, they were taped and then retaped, and then you taped over the tape. And, you gotta remember two things. Tape was $200 an hour.
Right.
That was 2-inch tape. Taping was only used sparingly because it was so expensive, and the machines were $60,000 or $70,000, and that was at a time when $60,000 or $70,000 was a bunch of money.
That's true.
Still a bunch of money.
It is.
Yeah, so you got to remember the tape was not used except sparingly when they absolutely positively had to. I'll tell you the way that the only tape that's really left is from 1963, and it's because the tape was fairly new then, and, 4 or 5 years old.
Right.
And I sent a 2-inch tape, which I bought from WSB, and had them tape for me as a favor. I sent it to my friend in Burlington, Vermont, who also did a kid show. He was a former Army buddy, so I could see what we were doing.
Right.
And he then taped over it so I could see what he was doing.
Oh, God.
Well, he didn't tape over all of it. His tape was shorter than mine. His segment was shorter than mine. So there's that piece left, and I still have that.
How long is that?
20 minutes.
Wow. From 63?
Yeah, in black and white.
There don't seem to even be even a whole lot of pictures left.
No, a lot of them are... I don't know how many pictures there are. One of the photographers or studios that took a lot of pictures gave the pictures to library or archive at the University of Georgia, and I have no idea where they are.
Now, when did the clubhouse gang stop and the Popeye Club start?
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't remember those dates. You know, it was all the same to me.
Right.
I was annoyed when they would change the name of it because I thought that was lousy marketing. I still do.
Well, the clubhouse gang had more Laurel and Hardy and Little Rascals kind of things.
Yeah, it was all Little Rascals, as I recall. And then they changed it into Big Adventure, and they had Flash Gordon and that kind of thing, Tarzan, you know.
Moana Jim?
Yeah, all that. And they wanted to dress me in a leopard skin. I really revolted there because it would have been revolting. anyway, then it became the Popeye Club, and the ship finally became part of the set, and that was the one that I guess most people remember.
Is that when Terry Kelly came along?
No, he came on a little earlier than that. You know, I can't remember when he came on, but he was a boon to the show. He gave it new life and new excitement, and he was a clever, clever kid, and he would dream up bits. And of course, we never rehearsed them. He would not tell me what the bit was going to be so that my reaction would be fresh, and it was. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful kid. He's dead now. Terry died early, in his early 50s.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, me too. He and I remained friends, a kind of father-son relationship.
Well, you did... most of the spots that ran, well, not all, but a good many of the spots that ran were, you had to do them live.
Well, those days, a testimonial from the person who did the show was considered valuable by the advertisers.
Well, you did, I think Bosco was a big...
Oh, yeah.
Boy, you
it
did
was
a,
wonderful. Yeah.
You did a lot of Bosco spots.
Oh, yeah.
And you always did a great job with them. They were all different and goofy and, you know, Officer Donnie.
Well, there was one, we used a boom mic in those days.
Right.
A lot of leaders were around, but they didn't use them because I moved around a lot. So one Bosco spot that I remember so very well was some kid, while I was doing the spot, reached up and grabbed the boom and screamed into the microphone, "I don't like chocolate." And I said, "I'll bet your sister likes chocolate." And he said, "No, she breaks out when she eats chocolate." It was an embarrassing moment.
Speaking of which, what was your most embarrassing or funny moment on that?
That might have been it. I was giving away Bosco as a prize at a game, and that's when that happened.
Well, Ooey Gooey sure drew a lot of attention. But the game, who came up with the game itself? Do you remember?
No. I think it was a committee thing. I don't remember. I really don't remember. If I did, I would tell you. But we had a turntable in the prop room that we used for displaying stuff. And it had been used for some kind of, you know, for moving pictures. And Bobby would stand out of camera range and make the turntable go. And we used that because it was in the prop room. And we decided we would do a kind of Russian roulette for kids with the bags.
Right.
And it just sort of grew. I don't remember.
Going back to the pictures that there are not so many left of, physically, but mentally, a lot of us still carry those great images in our head of the Popeye.
Yeah, so do I.
Well, you'd send me a picture of you when the show was in color with an RCA TK-42 on the set.
Yeah.
And now I understand that, you know, RCA knew you were probably one of the biggest kids shows in the country. And when that camera came out in 66, that they wanted to get those cameras into WSB and on the Popeye Club,
mm-hmm.
so that they could kind of see if the registration was right and, you know, everything was as advertised, you know, because that would have been probably one of the first maybe 10 cameras that went out, the two that went to SB.
That's true.
And that they had a tech there for months. The RCA kept a rep there that would send back reports to Camden on the camera's performance.
Yeah. We would often do a one-camera show because the other camera was back in the corner of the studio and the tech had his soldering iron and his magnifying glass out trying to figure out what was wrong.
Really?
Yeah, we often did in those early days of color. It was a one-camera show.
I'm sure you're still recognized every time you walk down the street.
Yeah, it isn't. It doesn't happen as often as it used to during the height of the Big Band, or the Officer John show. I could barely go out to eat because, you know, people would come up and want to talk. But, yeah, once in a while now, maybe once a week, somebody will do the Officer John thing. And it's gratifying. It gets old from my standpoint because it's repetitive. But, of course, from their standpoint, it's new. You know, they're for the first time seeing some guy that they saw on television. And so it's just gratifying to know that people think of you that way. And it's been an interesting life.
Well, you have a character on a sitcom created after you, don't you?
Not to my knowledge.
On Third Rock from the Sun?
Oh, yeah, that guy. Yeah, they did. The writers, of course, are from Atlanta, and they named him Officer Don Orville.
Right.
Or something like that. Yeah, that's true.
When Popeye ended in 70, how did it end? Was it your decision to move on, or was it, or what?
Well, they had started, we got a new program director, and he wanted to move it to Saturday morning.
Only?
Yeah. And he was just following the leader. All the TV stations were dumping their afternoon kid shows and moving them to Saturday morning. So I did the show every 5 days a week in the afternoon, but it wasn't on the air. They would tape that show for a half hour. It became a half hour show, so to speak. And then they would run the 2.5 hours on Saturday morning, the resulting 2.5 hours, the half hour a day, 5 days a week.
Right.
And I was uncomfortable with that because I thought we lost a lot of ratings and a lot of exposure.
Were you still doing great in the ratings in 70 in the afternoon?
No. That was when we moved. It was actually, I stopped in 69 at WSB. And I left and went to Channel 36 with the Popeye Club because they would put me on in the afternoon. Channel 36, a new station, you know.
Right.
So I thought, hey, this is a great idea. Let's go over to Channel 36. I can help them. They can help me.
So
and I took everything over there, the set, oil, everything. We moved over there, and, of course, it was not as well watched because nobody had UHF sets and very few.
Well, that's an interesting place to go. You know, you bought you got your revenge. You bought ATL.
And well, I got into some of the insides of of the company that ran it found out how weak they were.
Well, how did you feel owning a UHF at the time? Because, you know, there wasn't cable, really.
No. Well, it was an uphill deal, but I felt that it was the way to go. You know, sort of like FM was in 1960.
Were you worried about the viewers at home's ability on the receiving sets they had to get you?
Oh, sure. I think we plugged antennas, little loop antennas you could put on the back of your set to more effectively receive UHF, and we would plug tuners and that sort of thing.
I even
went out to one guy's house. He called and said, "I can't get you," and I went out and put an antenna up.
Now that service with a smile there.
Yeah, I'll say.
When did you get involved with WATL?
Well, it was 69. The last year of the Popeye Club was 69 and 70 on WATL.
And is that when you bought it?
No, it went off the air then. They went into bankruptcy. All of the stations they owned. They had one in Philadelphia and one in Pittsburgh and one in Cleveland, I think, and one in Atlanta. I'm not sure about the other cities. I'm sure about Pittsburgh because it was my home area. But anyway, they went bankrupt, and so we bought the frequency on the courthouse steps around 1971, but it stayed off the air then, as I explained earlier to you, until 76. We went on the air July 4th, 76.
So it sat for those years. When you went on the air, what was the programming like?
Well, it was silly. We did all live. I had a bug up my rear to do all live and do a talk show, like radio talk. Ring Radio was the only talk station in town at the time. Talk radio was relatively new, and so I thought, maybe this should be TV.
Right.
And so we had two-way talk with people on the phone. And that didn't work very well. And so after probably less than 6 months, we went to standard programming with syndicated shows and that sort of thing.
Is that kind of when Georgia News Network came into being?
No, it came into being before. I was waiting for the FCC to get off their stupid rear ends and give me an authorization to go on the air. And so I started the Georgia News Network, and that was in 1972.
Now, you had was it the Atlanta or the Georgia franchise for Muzak? You had that way back during the Popeye Club, didn't you?
Yeah, it went on the air. That's why the reason I quit doing the news, because I quit the staff at WSB, and they paid me on a contract basis to come in and do the show an hour each day. So but I was actually working full-time for my own background music company, which was called Kenco, K-E-N-C-O, Kenco Music. And I was a partner there with John Cohn. He was the Cohen Kenco.
What area did you service?
Well, we serviced the 60-mile radius of Atlanta. The whole theory being that we were, I leased the sub-channel of WAGA FM.
Ah.
103.3 at the time. And because Muzak was wired, we could compete with them on a one-to-one basis because they couldn't afford a phone line beyond about 20 miles.
Oh, so you were competing with Muzak?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I see. I thought you were a Muzak franchisee.
No, we competed with them because they were still on phone line.
Oh, so that must have been, those sub-carry channels must have been something that you were interested in when you bought WKLS.
Actually, it was the sub-carrier that made me put KLS on the air.
And that was a brand new, I guess you got a construction permit?
Yeah.
And that what year was that, Don?
We went on the air December 2nd of 1960.
And that was, I guess, easy listening?
Oh, yeah. It was easy listening for 10 years until we sold it in September of 70. And then they became 96 Rock eventually.
Yeah, I worked on 96 Rock. Mm-hmm. It was a good station.
When you had
KLS, was it right there by 85?
Yeah, it was on Barnes Mill Road on Blackjack Mountain, which is east of Marietta Trifle. We had a shack up there, and we had a studio and a transmitter, and it was just a shack. What we did was build a tower at the top of Blackjack Mountain because it was cheaper to buy land on the top of a mountain. At the time, nobody was up there. Now there's a bunch of condos up there. It's a classy place to live because of the view. But at the time, nobody wanted it, and we bought an acre or 2 or 3 acres and built a shack, just like a transmitter shack. It was really a crummy building and a 300-foot tower, 320. So we got our height from being on the land, the high land.
Well, that was... Needless to say, a good investment. I've read that you started the station for about $25,000 and sold it for about $750.
Yeah, that was it.
Not bad.
No.
Where did you meet Herb Gershon, by the way?
Well, Herb and I didn't really know each other very well, but he was into computers, and when I started doing the Big Band Jump newsletter, I was doing Big Band Jump and working... part-time, I think, at Ring. And I met Herb there. Oh, I'd known Herb before by reputation, but Herb helped me put together the newsletter. He knew how to work PageMaker and all that stuff. And so he still does it.
Well, he's a great guy. I worked with him at
V103. Mm-hmm.
They have a great, great voice. One of the great newsmen.
I'll say.
Yeah. Now, Big Band Jump... is something you've always loved, this big band stuff. I mean, you cut your teeth on it, and now you're back into that and have a 200 or so syndicated stations where you're...
We're down to 100. We're down to 100 stations, affiliate stations, because the complexion of radio has changed a great deal.
As far as a Big Band Jump, now, how long has that been going on?
Well, it's been going on locally since about 82. I'm not sure of the date, but Jeff Walker, who used to work for me at Channel 36, was the student manager of WRIS, Georgia State Station, and he asked me to come down and play some of my big band recordings, and I did. And it seemed to go over well, and so he asked me if I would consider doing an hour a week. At 1 o'clock on Sunday, we called it 1 o'clock jump. And so I did, and for a couple of years, and two or three or four years. And finally, somebody wrote a postcard from Smyrna and said, "That's a pretty good show, why don't you syndicate?" And I'd never thought about it, but I figured if a listener thought I should syndicate, maybe I should. So I started a syndication. First on reel-to-reel tape, and then eventually on cassette and so forth. And now, by STP or FTP, I keep wanting to make it oil, FTP on the computer. So we've had as many as 200 stations with our two-hour weekly Big Band Jump is the way it came out. When we changed the name of it to fit whatever time happened to be used by the station.
Do you have any worldwide exposure on that?
Yeah, I get letters from people in Russia, Switzerland, England. I get a lot of mail from England, the emails. The Internet has been a boon to this kind of thing, and I think the way the Internet's going, it'll probably replace radio unless the FCC gets off their duff and does something a little progressive and maybe some inventive forward-moving ideas. But that's another story. Yeah, we get South Africa. American Letter last week.
I hate to say this, but, you know, having been on the air myself from about 1965 or 66 till about 95, I have not listened to terrestrial radio any since then.
Isn't that amazing?
I listen to satellite radio now.
Yeah.
I can't listen to the other stuff anymore.
Yeah, well, I think that's happening a lot, especially among younger generations. The older generations don't even have computers. I get to talk to them a lot when they call, you know, to give program suggestions and that kind of thing.
Right.
And they don't want computers, and they don't, even when we're on a computer, sometimes the local station will stop carrying our show, and they'll say, well, how can I get it? Maybe they'll email me, and I'll say, well, you're on computer. You can punch it in and listen to it anytime you want. And he says, oh, I don't want to listen to it on the computer. I want to listen to it on the radio. Well, you know, it's a, that's just a mindset.
It is.
And there's no way you can get over that with certain generations, of which I am one.
I understand. My mother is one, too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 81. I've been in, but I can't think that way because I don't. You know, I've had to keep up with it. But to me, retirement is tantamount to dying.
What do you think of the way that media has changed since the time that you first got your feet wet in it?
A quotable quote is the consolidation of radio resulting in the computerization has taken the heart out of radio broadcasting and lent a great deal to the impersonalization of radio as we know it today. And that's the quotable quote.
I have to agree with you.
I detest computers. Not because they're not helpful. I have three of them, you know.
Right.
But to use them as programming devices and do voice tracking so that you have no association with the music, either emotionally or on your frontal lobe, makes no sense at all.
No,
you can't produce a show if you don't hear the show.
That's true. One of the saddest things I ever saw in my life was about a year ago. I went to WSB. I'd never been in the new building.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a tour, and I went, and we went down in the radio area. It was, I guess, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the four studios for each of their, you know, Cox on station there.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a light on in any of the control rooms. There was not a sound coming out of any of the 24 monitors in that room, and it was just one of the most depressing things I've ever seen. A friend of mine who used to program Y100 in Miami is now programming in Los Angeles and said, you know, in the old days, we used to have to program against and fight, you know, the guys down the street. But now we have to fight to beat the guys down the hall, and that's really a shame.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? It's a joke.
Don, I want to thank you for sharing your memories today. And I don't just mean today, August the 2nd, 2011, because from here on, today is going to be whatever day in the future that someone listens to this. And preserving this information is why we're doing this. Very few, if any, have ever done what you've done. And for what you have done so very well, thank you so very much. Bless your heart, sir.
Okay. We'll see you later.